Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we ask brilliant educators everything you've ever wondered about teaching English language learners. I'm your host, Liesl Koop. I'm an ENL teacher and resource specialist with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back this week, listeners. I am really excited about our episode this week. Last week, you got to hear Dr. Ivania Soto talking about conversations and L shadowing, particularly at the high school level. And this week, you're going to get to hear a similar conversation, but really directed towards students at the elementary levels. Our burning questions for this episode are, what is the role of conversational discourse or academic conversations in the learning experiences of elementary English language learners? And the second question is, what can teachers do to be more intentional about creating speaking opportunities for English language learners? And our special guest this week is someone whose work has really helped me as a classroom teacher and as a coach, really understanding practical and effective ways to build speaking into classrooms with English language learners. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Zweers. Hi, Dr. Zweers.
Hi, how's it going?
Pleasure Pretty to be good. Here. Thanks for being here. For those listeners who may not be familiar with you or your work, could you share what your title or your current role is?
Yeah, I'm called a senior researcher in the Stanford Grad School of Education, but I don't do a lot of the typical, I guess you'd call it research, particularly the spreadsheet type of research that a lot of people do. I tend to spend more time in classrooms with teachers, co-planning, coaching, that kind of thing. So it's a little fuzzier than the, the different numerical based research, but it's a lot more fun.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be. What are your special areas of interest or research? Obviously, today we're talking about academic conversations. Is that your main area of focus, or are there other areas that you work on?
Well, for quite a while, I would say up until a couple of years ago, I mostly focused on academic conversations, building conversation skills. And then just recently, I guess I would say I branched out a little bit to focus on authentic communication, which some of the focus came from looking at academic conversations, but really kind of branching out to reading, writing, listening, speaking, but making it more authentic. What I started to notice was that in a lot of classrooms and curriculum materials, there was what I called pseudo communication, meaning that kids would use kind of the bare minimum of language to get something done, but get their points. So it was sort of an external or extrinsic motivation rather than actually communicating for a purpose or a reason. So I've kind of branched out a little bit. It's been a little overwhelming for both me and for the some of the teachers I've worked with to think about all the language skills and making them more authentic. So I'll still tend toward the conversations, but I also try to mention, in writing too, there's that idea of authentic audience and authentic purpose that we really need to shore up and not just kind of give it lip service. So that's kind of what I've been doing lately, is looking at curriculums. I just had a conversation with some English language development teachers the other day, and they said, well, this is something we just need to rethink how we teach, because the whole point-based teaching doesn't last as long, and we've realized that for a while, but we need an alternative.
So that's kind of what we're doing. Yeah, that's really interesting. Thank you. What drew you to working with English learners?
My first, few years of teaching, that's who I had, in my classroom predominantly, and so I just was fascinated with language and different ways of viewing the world and different ways of describing the world and the challenges that a lot of English learners or multilingual learners came, when they came to this country, the challenges they had, particularly in different curriculums and classrooms that weren't very well prepared for them. So that's kind of what, you know, one of the main draws. And also just to see their passion for learning and their passion for relationships was also really exciting. So it was a kind of a good fit.
Great. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about talking. Mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about today.
Yeah.
The first thing I kind of like to do when we're talking about a specific topic on one of our episodes is make sure that everybody who's listening has a common understanding of really what we're talking about. So today we're talking about academic conversations. Mm-hmm. So when you are talking about academic conversations, are you thinking about a particular structure in your mind? Like, what has to be included for something in your mind to be considered an academic conversation?
Yeah, and I've spent a lot of time, and a lot of teachers I've worked with have spent a lot of time just listening in on conversations that kids have. And a couple of things that really they should have is they should build up at least one idea. So for example, if you and I are talking about the theme of some story, let's say, well, we can't just say, well, I think the theme is this. Oh, I agree. That's not a very strong So what am I looking for? I'm looking for them building that up. And so they build up the idea, or we, if it's me and you, would build up that idea using other skills of clarifying and supporting. So those are some of the skills that I've been, you know, pushing for quite a few years. But just realize that they're very important for building up an idea. So we need to be on the same page with what certain often abstract terms mean. Right, we can't just say things and assume everything is understood perfectly by the other people. But then we also, of course, and we've been doing this for years too, of supporting it, particularly in writing. And we've been pushing kids to support their ideas in, like, let's say, whole class discussions or teacher to student. But what we really want to get to is student to student. So students push one another to both clarify and support and build up the idea, and this is important expression, as much as possible. What a lot of kids have in their minds is the bare minimum for however many points I want to get in whatever task I'm doing. And so somehow, you know, we haven't need to start this early on or definitely in the beginning of the year. We build up a culture of, we build up ideas as much as possible. Now I'm going to try to make it as interesting and engaging and also give you choice of ideas to build up. I'm not going to tell you, you have to build this up or it becomes less interesting. So if kids come into that conversation, I want kids to walk over or whatever, turn to their partner with the mindset, hey, we're going to build up an idea here. If it's an argument type conversation, then it would be building up two ideas, mm-hmm. right? So I'd build up two opposing ideas or the top two ideas, and then I would have to do another skill, which is evaluate which one weighs more, evidence-wise. Mm-hmm. So if I wouldn't use the clarifying as much, you know, but if I build up the idea, clarify and support, then I do it with the other idea. And we would do this together. And this is one of the things that I've noticed and pushed quite a bit is collaborative argument. And it's been used in various ways, you know, in the literature in the last 20 years or so, but collaborative argument really in my mind means you and I suspend our opinions for a little while. We put them in the back of our head. We don't just jump in and say, oh man, I got to win this and I'm not going to listen to your side. We say, okay, which side do you want to start with? Which side do you want to start building up? We're going to build up both sides. Teacher has to give time for that. We're going to build up both sides of the argument. And then we're going to decide after that. Now, after we've built up both sides, and we do the evaluation, you and I might value evidence differently. So for example, if you value privacy more and I value, let's say, security or whatever my idea of security, then we might agree to disagree in the end, but at least we've both built up both sides. We haven't hijacked the conversation or cut it apart before we've seen both sides. And this is, you know, the reason I'm spending so much time talking about this is because when you look at what's going on in, you know, the media and it's been going on for a long time, you see that the lack of this type of, I would say, critical thinking or, you know, logical reasonable argument and collaborative argument, rather than you see this kind of competitive and biased argumentation. So those are the kinds of, you know, there's two, in my mind, there's kind of two big types or buckets of conversations. One in which we're working together to build up one idea, you know, maybe it's a solution to a problem and we decide on it, or the theme, or we agree on something, we're creating a product. Or the other would be this kind of argument type where we have to build up both. So I'm looking for those skills, along with, of course, I'm looking for respectful valuing of others' ideas, you know, not just shoving them aside. I'm looking for nonverbal communication strategies as well, right? Because that can make a big difference as well. Yeah, so that's probably a long answer to that question.
That's great. And I love that practice of collaborative argument. And I was thinking the same thing as you were saying, you know, what we see modeled for our students and for ourselves in real life does not echo that practice. So
I know.
It's such an important thing to teach our kids. That's really mm-hmm. fascinating. Mm-hmm. What does research show about multilingual learners, or all kids really, speaking in school? What have you found that research shows about that?
Well, I mean, that's kind of a broad question. I think in last week's podcast with Ivania, you probably talked about how a lot of the shadowing research has found that kids don't talk much, right? Especially multilingual learners or English learners. So that would be one thing that's pretty agreed upon, is that kids in general don't talk much, and English learners will tend to talk less, less than that, right? And so, and that's been fairly consistent over the years. It's gotten better in some pockets. And so, what is that's and that's mostly based on quantity. And so, what I found, and I haven't seen a lot of research, but the research that looks at, you know, what about the quality of talk? Let's say they are talking. Is that just enough? You know, do we say, oh yeah, I talk for, you know, 3, 4, 5 minutes in this classroom and I'm happy with that. But really, I think what, you know, again, we're getting into what the research needs and is looking at some of the quality of talk that kids are engaging in, and even the different structures that they're engaging in. Because if you count a whole class discussion where a kid says one thing, it was a really good thing. Still, that's just a few sentences possibly in a whole class period, whereas you might have a small group where the kid might be either engaging a lot or not at all, because you can let the other, you know, two or three, or in a paired such situation. So I think I tend toward pairs, even though I've heard, you know, some good argumentation for triads as well, but I just tend toward the simplicity of pairs. And the fact that I'm always in a pair, I always have to be listening or speaking, right? I can't just check out. If I'm in a triad, I can kind of like, okay, what's for lunch when the other two are going? But if I have someone looking right at me like you are right now,
yep.
I either have to talk or I have to listen. So I tend toward that. But then when you get even deeper into, you know, it takes time and energy to actually delve into the quality of the talk. And in my mind, the quality of the talk would be scoring high on some of those things I just mentioned before, you know, and what are we looking for in a conversation? Those conversation skills, those nonverbal, those valuing of others' ideas, and really pushing yourself. I mean, I really value it when kids go beyond, like, I love it when they, most teachers don't, but I love it when they go beyond the, you know, when the cutoff time, mm-hmm. if they're on task, right? So that's great, because they are really trying. They realize the cutoff time, but hey, I want to finish this thought, or yeah. Hey, we gotta keep doing this because I'm trying to build up this idea. That's what we're looking for. I what I don't like is when, you know, the like do the little beep or the clap or whatever, and all of a sudden, quick, it's completely silent. Kind of like they were waiting for it, right?
Right, exactly. Right.
I'd rather have them a little bit of overlap. But yeah, there isn't a ton of research, I would say, on the quality of talk, particularly by English learners. It's a really hard thing to research, because it's so time and labor intensive, right? Particularly if you're looking at nonverbal, you have to take video and then you have to look at the video, and you know that it just takes. There's some, but there needs to be more.
Yeah, so anybody listening who is interested in doing that research, you know, get on that. That sounds fascinating to me. Really cool.
And there's a lot I probably don't know about either, so.
In your experience, what role does speaking play in overall learning?
Oh, that's a good question. Now, when you say speaking, is that conversational speaking? I mean, I can lump it all into either conversational speaking or answering a teacher question, right? That people is, or giving an oral presentation. So there's different types of, I would say, speaking. For right now, I guess I'll just focus on the conversational speaking. Mm-hmm. And what happens in conversations, especially when you're speaking, is that you're, and I ask people after conversations a lot when I'm doing, you know, either in classrooms or work, and they say, well, you know, speaking about it actually helped me clarify what I knew and what I didn't know. And those two things are pretty important, right? Those, and that's just on the content side, the knowledge side of things. So, you know, I it helped me. And then a conversation, I'll get ideas from that. That would be listening, but I'll get ideas. But there's that side of things. There's the speaking. There's also in a conversation, there's the co-building. And I would also call that the agency, the feeling of agency. So when I'm speaking about something, especially if I'm getting some acknowledgement and some valuing from my partner, I feel pretty good. And that's important. That's not unimportant, right? It's in fact, some might argue that's the most important part of schooling, is if we can get kids to feel confident about their ideas and how they're expressing them, right? Even if they're not expressing them in perfect English, it doesn't matter. If they're expressing and building up a novel idea that they haven't had before, let's say, or they think is pretty cool to build up with another person, then you have that agency. Of course, you also have language development, because, you know, practicing, as some research has shown, you have to produce output as well as receive input, and that output helps you, especially if you have an engaged listener. And this is important, because what I'll do if I say something like, "Oh yeah," and he just didn't know where he was, and I say something that isn't understood, and I see a face, like, I don't see a head nod, I see a a head cocked to the side, I will re-say that. I realize that what I said, what either a word I said or the way I said it, didn't work, and so I'll say it again. And so that's the kind of thing. That's that real time, and I would say probably vital practice that kids need. And then they get to say it, say it a second time, because it's just you and someone else. It's not me saying something and thinking I have to say it perfectly in front of the class. So that's the kind of thing, you know, where and that's a lot of where language development comes in the first place, right? As little kids, especially, a lot of my communication research is based on first language development, because a lot of kids, all they care about is communication, right? They're not getting points.
Right.
Right. They just want to communicate and hopefully be communicated to at times. But that's where, that's I think where the brain gets its language the most. Now, granted, you can memorize grammar and you can memorize vocabulary lists, and some of that stuff will stick. But most of our language really comes from that authentic interaction, not just speaking and listening, but the authentic interaction with text as well, right? I was just working with my daughter on writing something about animals in the area where we live, right? She was going to send it to someone. So, she wrote a lot more than I usually see when it's school.
Right.
Because she was authentically communicating. So I think that's where, speaking plays a role in that, especially if it's authentic, especially if I really want to talk to you and build something up. And if you really want to know something, right. If you don't want to know it, or you already know it, then, okay, maybe I'll try to make the teacher happy, but it's not authentic.
Right. That's such a good reminder, because I feel like even as someone who was trained to teach multilingual learners, I feel like so many of the speaking activities that I would create or design or implement in my classroom were not authentic. And as you know, as I look back on that, I'm like, it would have been actually so much easier to create authentic tasks. Like, why didn't I do that? That's really an aha moment, I think.
It's a little easier, somewhat easier. I mean, unless someone's really breathing down your throat and you have a mediocre ELD curriculum, it's a little easier to kind of come up with, you know, tweak the prompts or even come up with your own units, curriculums, texts, that kind of thing, to make it more authentic. But one of the goals that I've been, you know, pursuing is trying to enhance all activities in all content areas with these three features of authentic communication, right? So one of them is they build up one or more ideas. The second is they do that by there's a push for clarification and support, a little bit like the skills, you know, we talked about earlier. But there's an intentional, like, for example, instead of just saying, okay, you guys turn to a partner and tell each other this, I might say, okay, turn to each other and tell each other this, because that's going to help you build up the big idea that we're working on this week of dot, dot, dot. And I want to hear at least one clarify or support prompt from the listener. So notice that was, you know, there's a little more to just the basic turn and talk, but it added. And then the final feature would be there's an information gap. And so, and this would of course apply to conversations as well, but there's an information gap where it's turn to your partner and tell them something that they don't know. It's not just turn to your partner and tell them, you know, what we're looking at right up here in the front, because everybody can see, then I'm just flapping my gums. So if those, you know, those three features can exist, I think in every activity. And if they can't, I often say, well, is the activity needed? It's a little bit, I run into a little bit of a pushback sometimes, but if kids aren't, you know, they know it. If they aren't, it takes energy to talk, write, read, listen, converse. I'm not going to put the energy in if I think it's just for points, or I'm going to put the bare minimum in, right? And I realize there are kids that are like, you know, totally grade mongers. I'm not worried about those kids as much. I'm worried about the kids that don't care as much about those extrinsic rewards, and they end up doing just the bare minimum. So I think that's where those three features fit in, you know, especially for, you know, speaking, listening, and conversation, but they also fit into reading and writing. You know, how many kids, if they're not interested in a text, will reread it? No, not going to happen. In fact, a lot of kids don't read the text. They just know where to, you know, hunt and peck for answers to whatever questions or whatever prompts. So we're really, you know, we're trying to get around that and think, I want a kid to read that text, maybe even reread it, because he or she wants to do something with that information. Right.
I love that you asked, you know, if it's not authentic, you know, what's the point? Because just like you said, the kids are aware. They have that meter that can detect, mm-hmm. like, this is just busy work, or this is really mm-hmm. something that is valuable to me and to my teacher. I think mm-hmm. we need to, you know, trust that the kids there, they can feel that and they can measure that. And that's especially so important for the kids you're talking about who are not motivated by grades. Those are the kids mm-hmm. We really want to hear their voices too. And you've alluded to this a little bit, you know, in talking about authentic communication, but what is the role of these kind of academic conversations in overall literacy development? And I kind of have a two-part question here. I'm just curious why you think there's been such a focus on reading and writing when it comes to English language arts standards, and not as much of a focus on speaking and listening. At least that's what I've experienced.
Yeah, I think there's several reasons for that. One is just testability, accessibility. You know, we're pretty cheap overall, and we don't want to, you know, pay for speaking and listening types of assessments. That's one thing. I think that's one of the main reasons. Another is just, you know, there's this sense that school is kind of reading, writing, and arithmetic still, right? There's a sense that You just have, and you know, reading and writing are vital, not saying they're not. But because the tests are mostly reading and writing, that's where curriculums have gone, right? And so that's where the teaching kind of has gone over the years. It's also quiet. So in some people might like the quiet nature of kids just reading or kids just writing. Yeah. And that's, that's kind of preference. And there just hasn't been a lot of value, for the last whatever, you could say 100 years or 200 years in school itself. And so I would say that what I've seen and what a lot of teachers have noticed is that increasing the high quality oral tasks can increase reading and writing a lot. In fact, one activity that I've done a lot and that a lot of teachers have done a lot is called a stronger and clearer each time. It's nothing highly complex. It's like three pair shares in a row. But the catch is each time your oral language needs to get stronger and clearer. Instead of just saying the same thing, like a give one, get one each time, which kids will, it's easier to just say the same thing each time or even less. You say, no, every time you talk, it has to be stronger and clearer than it was before. And there's a pre and a post writing component to that. So when kids, notice the difference between, after they've talked with two or three peers, their writing it just basically gets a lot better. Most of the time gets stronger and clearer, the writing it does itself. On the reading side as well, the more that kids are using more and more complex oral language in different ways, then and hearing different ways of language use and ideally referring to the text, in these tasks, then their reading is going to get strengthened too, right? Because they're going to that vocabulary will build, especially if you're using that vocabulary a lot. I have one structured interaction activity called pro-con, also a very simple activity, but what kids do between the pro and the con is they have to use a more academic-ish transition, like however, on the other hand, or then again. So when they use that, more or less face-to-face oral language, more or less authentically, that becomes a part of, and so then when they read those expressions, there's also other academic language they can use in this activity. But when they start seeing that, it becomes automatic, which is what we need to happen. Because if a kid misses a however in a text, that can really throw them off comprehension wise, right? Suddenly the author is changing directions completely. But if you miss that, boom, your comprehension suffers. So, that's just a small example, but the more language that gets used, and especially the more language that you're hearing from a variety of people, the more your reading's going to strengthen.
That's really interesting. And it's just bringing back that kind of idea of authentic communication and using, really learning from text and using that in real life with a friend, I think is so powerful. Cool. How do you think teachers who are working with brand new English learners, how can they get students who are at that stage of English proficiency to feel more comfortable speaking in the classroom?
Yeah, that's a common question, right, that comes up a lot. And in some cases, it depends on, in most cases, it's going to be a few, like a handful of students. I'm not talking about a beginning ELD class, right? You're talking about the teacher who has a wide range of proficiencies and, a new student shows up. There are various ways to scaffold these tasks. Some of which is building that culture of respect and patience in the classroom in the beginning of the year, right? And just telling kids, hey, we're all working together. We say things different ways. Some of us have different language backgrounds, but we really have to work together to communicate with one another. It's not just about, it's not, we're not competing with one another. We are a team, that kind of thing. So that's, you know, one of these foundational ways to do it. Now, of course, in some of these activities, you're going to want to, you know, create adaptations. I've heard of teachers use more posters on the wall, and you know, they keep them up there. Like for the pro con thing I just mentioned, there would be a T chart, and there could be even, you know, just words, but also even, you know, if you wanted to put images up there just to remind kids of what they can say. And they don't have to use complete sentences, right? But they should just communicate, right, authentically. And there's, you know, there's other adaptations, for example, conversations where you can have, use more notes, whether it's visual notes or taking notes. And you can tell kids, especially, let's say, a more fluent, more proficient kid, you know, really, we want you to be communicating these ideas, and you need to learn how to, you know, modify your language, use visuals, use gestures to communicate to whoever, you know, whoever your partner is. And so now, that all that being said, it still isn't an easy answer. It's never a, oh yeah, I've got the, you know, the right answer for that. Just,
oh, come on. Time, right?
No, because it's really, you know, it's one of those big challenges that, you know, really can't go away. There's no easy answer for most of, you know, most of what we do are in school is pretty language heavy. And so when you have a kid who particularly comes from, you know, it brings in a language that without a lot of cognates, and it's just, you know, it's a challenge. It's just a big challenge. So I'm not going to say those are easy answers for that question.
In one of our episodes, we had a writer and coach, Elena Aguilar, as a guest, and she said that in her mind, in equitable classrooms, English learners or multilingual learners are speaking. Do you think, and if you do think, how do you think speaking or conversations like you're talking about today in school, how is that connected with equity?
Yeah, I think, you know, like I mentioned a little bit in the beginning, the sense of agency and voice, it does offer, you know, kids, as we know, bring in just this really, you know, rich fund of experiences and opinions and knowledges. And if they don't get a chance to share them, especially if, you know, if they don't want to write them down, and if they don't have these chances to speak with other students, which are a little safer usually, I would say that, you know, forcing kids to talk in front of a whole class is a little too much in most cases. So I really try to use the small groups and the pairs to allow kids to have that voice to share their. Now, you also have to get to know the kids and come up with the prompts that you think will help in that. You can't just, you know, oh, pairs will work automatically, right? Well, what they're being asked to do might not be interesting to them. And so it some of it, I think, depends on what the unit is and how, you know, how we, the teachers, are prompting and engaging them to build up these ideas that we, you know, so they need to have a sense of what they're learning, right? Whether I pull them aside at some point, or whether, you know, there's a little section where, hey, let's talk about the big idea we're building up right now. And this should be up on the wall or on a piece of paper. So at least they're, you know, they have that purpose. And then you know, I'll bring up that other feature of information gap. If I prompt them to share something that they know that other people don't know, I mean, they might come from a different background or different, then they're more likely to push themselves, even if, you know, even to really struggle to share it. Now, they could have someone help them out. It could be a drawing, whatever it is, but at least you're getting them to share in this process of our entire, like, you know, collaborative building of knowledge. And that's, you know, I know that sounds kind of fuzzy, but I think that's, you know, that's where kids want to be. They even the first week or two, yeah, they might not speak, you know, a lot, but at the very least, they're involved, right? They're involved and they're respected, and their ideas are being respected. I don't know if that is clear enough, but
yeah, no, it is. It just you know, brings back a common theme that I've heard in a lot of conversations I've been able to have in this podcast, which is really just coming back to knowing our students and making sure our students feel safe and like they belong and that their voice matters, which is what it's all about.
Yeah. And I think we have to also delve into what equity really means. I mean, it's a big term, and I think it's also a misused term sometimes. I think, for example, if people are just thinking about equity in terms of test scores, that, oh, I got to rate, you know, I have to provide different support so I can get kids up to the test score that I want them to be at. That's not equity, right? And I think, you know, the more we delve into that and spend time reflecting on, well, what is, you know, what do we really want for our students, right? I don't want them all to be equal. I don't want them to, you know, if that's what equity means to some people, I don't want them all to be equal. I want them to all excel to their potential, right? In all these areas that we're looking at, and you know, be the kids they're meant to be and want to be. And I think that's where when we slap on them these, I would say, these not so engaging curriculums, that just, you know, they, hey, here's a text on this thing I'm not that interested in, and then you're making me do a task or test that I'm not that interested in, you know, they start, and especially if you don't let me talk and share some of my own thoughts on this, yeah, I'm going to check out. So anyway, that's a whole.
No, that's what we're talking about. That's why we're talking about this.
Yeah.
Shifting gears a little bit, you know, as a teacher, I always want to know, what can I do that's really going to be impactful for my students? And so our second question for today revolves around what can teachers do in terms of creating speaking opportunities or conversational opportunities. So how can teachers model the kind of academic conversations that you're talking about?
Yeah, that's a good question as well. I've seen teachers use kids before as models. And most of the time, you know, I've been focusing on paired conversations. So they'll put a pair of kids up there. And it might not be perfect, but they will have set them up beforehand, maybe talk to them after school the day before, after class, and just say, you know, these are kind of things we'd want to hear in this. They wouldn't read it, but they would be doing that. Now, you could also have teacher and student. Which also works, because then I can model with you some of the things I would like to hear and, you know, hear and see. And I would also model listening and that listening and nonverbal. That also can work. And then if you get to the two teacher thing, that's when kids check out pretty quickly.
So it's like, they don't want to hear us talk anymore.
No. So you can kind of get away with the teacher student thing for a little while, but, you know, these are all kind of fishbowl like, you know, conversations, but ideally you want a couple kids, and you don't always want the most verbose kids, right? Highest profile kids in the class that are always in, you know, you'd want to, you know, pick a different sets of kids and you'd want to prepare them. And some of they would actually benefit from your preparation as well, a little bit, the actual two kids, right? So that's one way to model. Another is, you know, showing, you could show, and I've done this, you show transcripts, short transcripts up on the wall, and you say, okay, well, what skills are we seeing here? You know, this is the idea they were trying to build. Where does it go wrong? You could show wrong, you know, you could show bad conversations up there and say, well, why is this not good? Because let's say, you know, the second partner didn't even go with the first idea that was posed at all. He just shifted to his. He said, I disagree, and this is what I want to talk about, right? So you could show that and kind of make it, you know, make it obvious some of the mistakes that the common errors that you see. Yeah, beyond that, it's tough to show videos. You know, I do have teachers show videos of conversations, and I've heard some successes of where they've had videos in one class, and either they show the conversation to the same class or to a different class. You know, I've seen that as well. So those are the kind of the main ways. There's also, you can also model some of the skills somewhat in a whole class setting, right? You're saying, okay, and this, we are now, you know, we're building up this idea, and you know, Marco says this, instead of me just immediately responding, which is normally what happens kind of in that, you know, IRE sort of format, I would say, okay, how might someone respond to that? What could we say to what he just said? Right. So instead of me doing it, I'm pushing it out on them. And that would just be modeling, you know, this is what they need. They need like immersion modeling all the time in this kind of thing. Or it becomes, they'll just look at me, the teacher, to do all the conversational handling, right?
Yeah. I love that simple shift to recenter the kids. I think that's just something that maybe we didn't always practice when we were taught how to be teachers and when we began teaching. I think that's just an easy way to put it back on the kids.
Yeah.
I once heard somebody say, an educator that I admired say, if a kid can do it, I'm not doing it. And I loved that because it's just a reminder to make space for the kids to do the work.
Exactly. Yeah.
What tools or resources can teachers use to cultivate those kind of academic conversations, particularly with elementary L's?
Yeah, there are assessment-ish tools that I usually recommend. Well, first of all, if you make it a self-assessment of kids, then they have a real simple something, right? Just a couple, maybe they're working on one skill for this month or that month, but they can rate themselves. And how well did you clarify in this last conversation? Boom. It's like a little short self-assessment exit ticket type thing. For teachers though, I usually recommend looking at, a conversation assessment tool, just a list of the skills that you want to see and then memorizing it and then not having it written down. That's what I usually recommend because it's really mostly about this kind of formative assessment and observation. You're not going to have time to record and then write down all this stuff. I would just say, kind of have that in your mind basically as a tool to help you, because then, you know, if you know I'm looking for these skills and I'm watching a pair, I can you know, help them provide feedback, whatever. Right. And then in terms of for the kids, I would say, one thing that I've seen people have some good luck with is this, building kind of, it looks like a bunch of building blocks with the idea on the top. So it's like a visual organizer that just has, you know, the idea on the top that they're building. And then down below, they'll put notes on, and this isn't just for the conversation. This would be for maybe the entire unit. So they have this, and they can bring this graphic organizer to the conversation that's half filled, and they don't completely fill it out, but they might add to it. So it's something where I know that I'm talking with you, I'm going to add a couple things. Oh, I already had a couple things that you mentioned, and then I go to someone else and I talk with them. This is how we do life too. So it's an example that this organizer is something that's actually, it's kind of in your mind. We're doing this all the time. You know, we have, you know, hundreds of ideas that are half built, somewhat built, just beginning, some are, you know, quite built. And for the conversation, that's kind of what the conversation does. It might not build up the entire idea. You might not get every single idea from that other person, but it's just, it's part of the process. And then for the argumentation, you would have, it'd be similar, but you'd have two ideas next to each other on a balance scale. I don't know if you've seen this, but it's an argument balance scale. And then you would just, you could fill that out as well with one partner. What I usually recommend is filling it out with one partner and having that, you know, I wouldn't call it a complete conversation because you're kind of filling out cards or boxes, but then you take that and you go to another partner and that's when you have the conversation. And there's an information gap there because you didn't, you know, you weren't talking with this new partner the whole time filling out the boxes. So you would have stuff to share that he or she wouldn't have, you know, heard exactly in the same way. So that's one way to kind of scaffold these conversations is with these visual organizers. And there's others as well, but I'll just mention, you know, the tools and the visual organizers for now.
Yeah. And I just want to encourage anybody who's listening to check out your book, The K-3 Guide to Academic Conversations, because for me, that was so helpful. It's so practical. It's so easy to understand and gives kind of step-by-step ways to introduce these new skills to kids, especially the younger kids, if they've never practiced those skills. And I'm going to link to that book in our resources page when the episode posts, but it's just so practical and easy to follow. And I think a great starting point for somebody who really wants to go deeper into how to do this and commit to that. Mm-hmm. So I just want to make sure that people hear the name of that, and I'll post it in our resources as well.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. We talked a little bit earlier about quantity versus quality, but I still want to know, how much time do you think students should spend speaking in elementary classrooms?
Oh, I hate that question. I honestly don't know, right? I mean, it's hard to give a number or percentage to that. But what I would say is that what I would recommend is try to get as much speaking, particularly in pairs, as possible until you feel it's too much. So,
<All right.
laughs> some teachers might hit the limit at 4 minutes. I don't know, but until you feel like it is unproductive, right? And this is regarding. I'm not saying, let them just go for 10 minutes because that might be too long for kids. They'll start getting off track. But for like the class period, let's say you say within a 45 minute period, do you have a 2 minute, pair share, which I would say also counts as talk. And then maybe you have a 3 minute conversation some other time. What I would say though is try to, like what I'm saying now, try to intersperse as much as possible. Kids cannot handle listening to you more than 4 minutes or 5 minutes. I usually give 5 minutes as a max. So after 5 minutes, they got to do something. They're not always going to want to write. And I know a lot of teachers are doing some great stuff for that, that post 5 minutes or that those interval. But talking is one way to do it. A lot of teachers use turn in talks, which is great. Can we even improve the turn-in talks is one of the questions, right? So like I said before, let's enhance the turn-in talks and help them build up conversation skills. In fact, let's do a lot of things where we can do, we can build up clarifying and supporting, especially those two skills, right? So that would be my recommendation would be, try to max it out and ask kids about it. Do they think they talk too much? Do they think talking helps? You could also observe kids, observe their writing. You can do there's a little, I don't know what you call it, activity assessment that I did with quite a few districts in California called a write, converse, write, where you just, a little bit like what I mentioned, the stronger and clearer, but this is just, you write a paragraph and then you converse about it with one kid, or more if you really want, but with one, and then you write about it again. And so that's also shows you that, oh, well, because in a lot of cases, a lot of either administrators and or teachers need convincing that more talk time is valuable, right? And that, the writing sometimes is a concrete way to show that. Say, okay, well, was this increase in writing or this increase in development of writing worth the 5 minute conversation that they had or the 4 minutes you spent on conversation? And it's not always for every kid, but if we look at it, for a lot of kids, it really helps, especially the kids that we're, kind of worried about. A lot of kids are reticent to write if they think they don't have stuff to write about, or they haven't kind of put some stuff into sentences already. And that's kind of where the conversation can help. And reading as well, right? They can have a conversation after reading something, and they can really solidify the comprehension of it. Might not motivate them enough to go back and reread it, but they might.
I love the videos that you share on your website, where we can actually see kids in the classroom practicing these skills. I think it's really cool to see it in action. Mm-hmm. And obviously these students have learned how to use these skills and how to apply them. And mm-hmm. it's really cool to just see the kids with teacher prompting or without, you know, continue the conversation. And I think that teachers will really like to see those if they haven't seen them before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have a couple questions that I gathered from teachers that we work with. One of them has to do with students' home language. So the teacher said, I don't speak the languages of my students, but I want to encourage them to speak in their home languages as well as in English. What kind of speaking activities can I create that will help my students learn and will also help me assess if they're learning the skills and information I'm teaching?
That's a good question. Well, I'm not sure if this teacher meant, can you pair up, you know, same language kids and have whatever, pair shares, interactions, conversations with. So I mean, you could do that, but then I would also want to see some kind of maybe a product of that in some way. And then I'd like to see what their, you know, some translation of that product, if possible. Now, I know that's not always possible. You know, you might have two kids speaking Amharic and then they're writing it down in Amharic. And but ideally, you would want at least them to. Even if you didn't get that, I mean, I'll backtrack a little bit. Even if you didn't get that translation, I would want kids to be doing that process, because then when, you know, when their English gets better, then you'll be able to see they've at least built that skill of building up ideas together. And they're getting that sense even from that visual organizer or argumentation, same way. Maybe you get to see that, but at least they're seeing that. And well, rather than doing it in Amharic or Spanish or English, they're at least building that, I would say, that key skill. Now, as in terms of assessing all that they're knowing and talking about, you know, if it's just in Amharic or whatever, then it's harder. I don't really have an answer for that.
There's a really cool video on your website. I believe the students are in ninth grade, they're both Spanish speakers. And you can tell as you're watching that one student is more proficient in English than the other student. And they have their conversation, a really rich conversation about literature, mm-hmm. using Spanish and English, which I think is really cool, where the one student who's more proficient in English can support the sharing of the ideas with the student who's less proficient in English. I love that mm-hmm. example. And I think mm-hmm. it's just that, to me, is really important for teachers to see that even though a student is not fully proficient in English, doesn't mean they don't have ideas that they want to share and like are really deep and profound related to the things that they're learning.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Another question teachers have asked, I don't know how to manage or assess a room full of speaking kindergartners. How do I make that work?
Oh, well, there's three easy steps. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, that's, you could also extend that up to, you know, first and second grade as well, right?
Yep.
And I have a kindergartner, and I can barely manage one. No, I would say that, there's assess and manage. We're kind of in that question, right? Uh-huh. And assess, I would just take samplings. For a lot of the kindergarten type settings, you know, you can put them on the floor and just kind of go knee to knee, and you can, you know, circulate around, but take samplings of what they're talking about in the conversation. I would also want them to use, you know, visuals as much as possible, where, you know, pictures and maybe building up ideas as much as possible. But for the most part, you're also trying to build some of those basic turn-taking, body language type of skills as well. So that's why knees to knees help. They're still going to get distracted. These conversations are going to last, you know, 30 seconds if that. But I would say just, you know, start by building that and then providing feedback and saying, well, I noticed that you were looking at the wall the whole time or looking at the outside. And, you know, it really helps to value, to look at the other person, and, you know, face them. Anyway, so I think in terms of that, assessing those kind of real basic level skills. In terms of managing, I would say, just like I said, you know, as much as possible, mix things up, have them talk about stuff that they are very interested in talking about, right? Maybe it's right after a video or right after a little, read aloud or something like that. And I have seen some, some good stuff happen as a result of that, because and I don't need to say this, but it's building up that type of routine in the beginning of the year that really helps, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the beginning of the year for kindergartners is like a month or two, right? Yeah. Where you're really building up. This is what we do when we turn and talk. This is how we look at each other. This is how we respond respectfully, that kind of thing.
Great. Yeah. What are some new ways you've heard of teachers incorporating academic conversations into their virtual learning spaces during the social distancing requirements we've been experiencing?
Yeah, I've done quite a bit of work just recently, as most people have, on how to basically get kids to converse remotely, and you can do it. And the problem is teachers are using different platforms, and some districts don't want them to use one or not do want them to use. And so I've run into that quite a bit. I know in Zoom, for example, you can have these breakout groups, and you can break, I've done it myself, break people up into pairs. I think Google Meets can do that as well. And you can get a recording of it. So what I've been recommending just for some of the teachers I've been working with lately is try breaking kids up into pairs on whatever platform you have, and then having them record their conversation and then send it back to you. So ideally, have a good prompt. It could be based on what they're learning in the tag, or could just be even an easier prompt or an argumentation prompt that's fairly, easier. Should we keep on doing remote learning forever? I mean, that's just a prompt that they could talk about. And then that would be in a way to assess their abilities, their conversation skills. You could also say, one thing that would have helped this conversation is having this graphic organizer of the seesaw or whatever it is. That's also a way to get kids hooked into improving their oral language skills. They also, some kids, and not every kid, a lot of kids are distracted or has stuff going on in the home and all that, but there is that connection that kids are, a lot of kids are desiring. So they don't mind it as much as, say, maybe we say, okay, you got to read a bunch of stuff, turn it in on Friday, right? Mm-hmm. Answer questions, it's something different, the interaction with a real person on the other end of the line. So there's some advantages to that. You're not getting the full body usually, and you're getting a lot of distractions in the background, but there are some ways to overcome that and actually leverage it a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's anything that's happening now as we're teaching and learning in this way that we could still use to our students' benefit once schools do reopen?
Well, I think, like I've said before, the building up of ideas, I think that stays pretty consistent. I would want, if a teacher said, have a conversation about this, I would want them to be thinking, I'm having a conversation to build up my idea about something like that. So as long as that stays consistent, it's not a, again, it's not a huge difference whether I'm talking to you like this and then we're recording it versus face-to-face, right? In some cases, there's more distractions at home. In some cases, there are fewer distractions at home, right? Because the classroom can be a very distracting place as well. So, and there's also maybe a little bit of prep time, right? Say, okay, prepare this for your conversation and then set a time, for you to have your Google Meet or whatever with your partner, rather than usually it's like condensed into 45 minutes.
Yeah.
So I think there are things, we can take advantage of, but also the carryover is it's very similar. There isn't a whole lot, look at us right now. We're it's an interview, but it's also, easily could be look like a conversation.
Right. Yeah. That's really great. Dr. Swears, is there anything that I didn't ask you that you wanted to mention for our listeners in terms of supporting students' academic conversations?
I guess I already mentioned just, try it. Try it online.
Just try it.
Try it online. Try it live. I remember one time I was in a fourth grade classroom and there was like 4 minutes left and we had done a highly structured, she had like prepared this pretty structured conversation. I said, Well, what if you just, you know, in the last 4 minutes had them meet with someone else and just talk, right, about this topic? And she said, well, I don't know. I don't know if I want to give them that kind of freedom, you know. And she was, I said, just try it. And of course, it, you know, like the kids were, they were engaged the whole time. They were on topic. And they said, oh, it was great to finally have a chance to just talk.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's what I would say. Just, you know, kind of try it out, whether it's online or not, and see what happens. And again, not going to be, you know, you're not going to have perfect conversations coming back to you the whole time. But it'll be something to work with and something to get excited about. And hopefully the kids will get excited about it as well, right? Especially if you give them some positive feedback and just say, oh, love that conversation. Wow, that can really go a long way.
Yeah, that's great. And like I said, I'll link to your website and the resources that you've created and shared with the field when we post the episode, because I know for me personally and for teachers that I've worked with, they've been so helpful. So I hope that others will find the value in them that I have.
Uh-huh. That's great. Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking with me today. This was really great.
No, thank you. I appreciate all your work and I hope it goes well in the next few months and years.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guests we had on today's episode or any of the resources we discussed, please find those on our webpage. This podcast is produced by Midstate Arburn at OCM BOCES, and our theme music is Sunbeam from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Our Burning Questions.